Yeah. I'm going to need a little help from Rabbi because we are going to read from the Torah today. So I'm not sure how we're, what the order is going to be here. So we're going to ad lib.
The Torah service and. That's how we're going to do it today. As soon as they're ready, you put that on. Please arise for the Torah. Our red Torah is the Sephardic Torah. It was made in the 1930s in Israel. The case is from the 1800s from Egypt, from Egyptian Jews. This one's taken out because this is the one that's going to be read. It happens to be in the right place or close to the right place so that the handling is a little bit less. And she did it herself. The Aliyah did that herself and looked at it herself. I kind of love it because that's for me to do. I got enough to do. So let's stand. If you're not, let's stand and begin the Torah service. When the ark would travel, Moses would say, "Arise, O Lord, and let your enemies be scattered. May those who hate you flee from before you. For from Zion shall go forth the Torah and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Blessed be he who in holiness gave the Torah to his people Israel." When the processional happens, the Torah doesn't go to you. Okay? In some extreme cases, if there's a person that is handicapped or something like that, then that's done for that person, but I don't see too many handicapped people besides me, right? And so, as it goes, come to the Torah. You can use a garment, the edge of the garment. You can use a book. Please don't use your hand. It not that there's anything against using your hand. It's we, out of respect, do that. Because if you recall that David's general used his hand to steady the ark in Samuel, and he didn't make it. And so that's because the Torah is not to travel in oxen pulling it. It's to travel with people pulling it. And the ark, four priests would handle the ark. So, you know, it's for four pistons, so it can move and what have you. It doesn't get that. So, out of that, there's a feeling that, you know, we should not do that. We should just use our garment or a book or whatever. Okay, we're processing the ark to not to happy music. We're processing the ark to poignant music. This is the theme from Schindler's List as performed by Maurice Clark. Vayivenso Aharon Vayomer Moshe Huma Adonai Veyafutsu Oyvecha Veyanusu Misanecha Mipanecha Ki mitzion tzetze Torah, ki mitzion tzetze Torah, udevar Adonai mirushalayim, baruch shenatan Torah, baruch shenatan Torah, leamo Yisrael, Big Du Chateau. opens it. Getting ready to open it up. Nitzavim. Vesod haTorah asher sam Moshe lifnei bnei Yisrael al pi Adonai beyad Moshe. Kavod. This is the, read it. Moses' place. Atem mitzavim. We will place it for the reader to come. The reader is called the Aliyah. The Aliyah from the word making Aliyah. To make an Aliyah to the Torah. It's a lady coming to read the Torah. And we will call her. Tamod Tiferet Va. Let me see. She's come. I just forgot how to say the last part of the name. Yada. Okay, Yada from my hand. She comes and we'll see if a yad is handed to her. Her name has Yada, which means given. She will come and mark it if it's where she wants it to start reading. Okay, and then to make the blessings, we respond. Baruchu Adonai Hamvorach, Baruch Adonai Hamvorach Leolam Vaed. Repeat. Baruch Adonai Hamvorach Leolam Vaed. Read. Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Asher Bakarvanu Mikol Hamim Benatan Lanu Et Torato. Baruch Ata Adonai Noten HaTorah. Amen. You may be seated.
Yeah. That's all right. I'll just use the yellow one.
TJ, she's actually, I'm going to intervene for her because we sprung this on her at the last minute. We're going to make her read the first verse, but she will go ahead and sing the portion that I really asked her to sing because it's kind of the finale for the message today. And I hope that it will mean something to you when we get there, because I know it means something to me. So she won't be singing this part. She's just going to read it because I sprung it on her last minute, so she didn't have a chance to practice.
Atem nitzavim hayom. Kuchem, lifnei Yudhevave Elohechem Rashichem Shevitechem Ziknehem Veshat. Veshat, what is that one? Veshat Rechem, Kol Ish Yisrael, which says, all y'all standing here today, this is this plural, all y'all standing here today, before Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, so then plural still, your chiefs, your tribes, your elders, it's from the word wise, and your officers, all men of Israel.
So the rabbi put me on the spot because he said I was supposed to have this, and that's kind of the pressure I felt the whole time when we're a religious experience. I went there for a wedding.
Oh, maybe you got married.
Yeah, it was an employee and a friend of mine who is an Israeli, worked here, had a couple, three really rough years in the United States. And the lady that he was associated with made his life a living hell. I've only met two people in my life that were demonically possessed, and she was the second one. And she's not been, to my knowledge, corrected from that. But it was a joyful time because we got to go see the other side of the misery that someone can, you know, perpetrate against someone else. So it was really fun because we went over for a wedding, and we have become friends with his family as well, and finally got to meet his wife, who we loved before we ever met her, and it was a wonderful time. And it wasn't until day before yesterday, I can think it was Thursday, we were at Shimon Rides Horses, and her riding coach's husband asked me about the trip, as many of you have. Thank you very much. And he said, you know, everybody's asking me for some sort of a spiritual experience that I was supposed to have, and I told him that I didn't have any significant life-altering feelings. And then I went on a 15-minute diatribe, and when I was finished, he said, well, you actually did have a spiritual experience, just not the one you expected. So now you're getting a dose of that. So as John said, put your body armor on, because I'm going to give you both barrels today. And I hope that it is well received rather than critically received, because it's intended to be a blessing and not a curse. Because we are in that section of the Torah. I titled this message, I don't usually put a title on things. The last 2 weeks I put titles on them. And this title of this message is, You Will Be an Example. You will be an example. You'll find out whether your example is a good one or a bad one, but the people of God's covenant will be made an example. And that's what this section is about. It really should be titled What Sam Did on His Summer Vacation, but we'll have to suffer through that. But it does happen to fit this parashat, so I was grateful when Rabbi offered to let me speak today, even though I don't really... I'm not averse to public speaking, but when I stand up here, I am terrified. I speak in public a lot, but this responsibility I don't take lightly. John, can you bring up the, Jacob, can you bring up the timeline? Now, this is difficult to see. Not sure what's the right one. This is difficult to see because of the size. I don't have a laser pointer, so I'm just going to walk over here and kind of point things out. And the history of the Israelites, or the Israeli people, starts back here. You know, we have creation, and then at the Tower of Babel, the people are divided. We have Abraham, who is chosen by God out of all of the people who have rejected him and gone pagan. I want to have a time to speak on that. Then we go to, Abraham, then we go Isaac, Jacob, And then the people go into captivity. Actually, it's slavery in Egypt. They go willingly, but eventually they're enslaved in Egypt here. Moses comes, a delivery from the Egypt. We spend 40 years in the wilderness because of the rejection of the land. And we're about to enter the promised land. The stage for this picture that we see is right here. Okay? Here's the rest of the period. This is when they enter the land with Joshua, King David's reign, Solomon, the temple. The two houses divide. We have the northern tribe and the southern tribe, and the northern tribe goes into captivity in Syria and then is dispersed forevermore to this day. It's dispersed throughout the world. The bottom line is the house of Judah, Benjamin, and the Levites stay behind in Judah, and they represent the Jewish people. And then they go through various, apostasies to finally exile in Babylon for 70 years. They come back out of Babylon, and that's the establishment of what the Jews call themselves, Jewish people. And then we go on from there. That's where we're at. We're right here. Just about to enter the promised land with the Israelites. I'm not sure why this is ringing. Okay, so John's handing out, because it's hard to see, John's handing out that timeline. So this is Moses speaking to the people. Before we get there, let's talk about what the land looks like at this time. Because it may lend some understanding as to why I didn't think I had this life-altering experience. Because at this time, these people are about to enter this land that's an extraordinary place. It's an extraordinary place. In 21 times, it's referred to by God himself as a land flowing with milk and honey. I don't know what that exactly means. Maybe bees and cows, But Leviticus 20:24, TJ, do you have your mic?
Yes.
Go.
But I have said to you, you shall inherit their land, and I will give it to you to possess, a land flowing with milk and honey. I am Jehovah, your Elohim, who has separated you from the peoples.
It's referred to a good land, over a dozen times, Deuteronomy 3:25.
This is Moses talking to...
This
please
stage
let
is
me go over and see the good land beyond the Jordan.
I think the battery's dying. I'll give you another one. Red one or blue. Yeah. So this is Moses pleading with God to let him go in just prior to this speech, actually. Within days of this speech, actually. This is Moses pleading with God to let him go into the good land because he knows what it's like. He knows how wonderful this place is, and he wants to go in with the rest of the people. This is him pleading in verse 25.
Please.
Is the red mic on? There you go.
Please let me go over and see the good land beyond the Jordan, that good hill country and Lebanon.
Okay. Can you turn that up a little bit more for us there, Joe? Appreciate it. The Torah refers to it as an exceedingly good land in Numbers 14:6-7.
And Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, probably murdered that, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes and said to all the congregation of the people of Israel, the land which we passed through to spy it out is an exceedingly good land.
The incident where Abraham and Lot's two tribal groups, or their herdsmen, get into a fight with one another, and they decide they're going to split up. they're sitting there in the valley, you know, and they're fighting away. We're too big to travel together, so let's split up. And Abraham was magnanimous, and he says to Lot, which way do you want to go? And of course, Lot looks around and he goes, I like that. That part's really good. I'm going to go that direction. That story is told in Genesis 13:10.
And Lot lifted his eyes and saw that the Jordan Valley was well watered, everywhere like the garden of Jehovah, like the land of Egypt in the direction of Zoar.
That one sounds like you're talking into a conduit.
It could just be me. Okay.
All right, go.
You want me to read it again?
Yes.
Okay. And Lot lifted his eyes and saw that the Jordan Valley was well watered and everywhere like the garden of Jehovah, like the land of Egypt in the direction of Zoar.
Okay, this is the Jordan Valley we're talking about. It was like the Garden of Eden. It's well watered, it's grassy, it's green, it's gorgeous, right? It's a beautiful place. Go back 40 years when we're at the sin of the spies on that timeline there before the 40-year wandering. The spies were sent into the land, and they give you a little better picture of what's actually going on in Numbers 13, 17 through 24, and then 26 and 27, if you'd read that.
When Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan, he told them, go up through the Negev and into the hill country. See what the land is like and whether the people are strong or weak, few or many. Is the land where they live good or bad? Are the cities where they dwell open camps or fortifications? Is the soil fertile, or unproductive? Are there trees in it or not? Be courageous and bring back some of the fruit of the land. So they went up and they spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin as far as Rehob toward Libo Hamath. They went up through the Negev and came to Hebron, where Ahiman, Sheshai, and Talmai, the descendants of Anak, dwelled. It had been built 7 years before Zoar in Egypt. And when they came to the valley of Eshcol, they cut down a branch with a single cluster of grapes, which they carried on a pole between two men. Let that sink in. They also took some pomegranates and figs. Because of the cluster of grapes the Israelites cut there, the valley was called the Valley of Eshcol. They brought back a report for the whole congregation and showed them the fruit of the land, and they gave this account to Moses. We went into the land to which you sent us, and indeed it is flowing with milk and honey. There is some of its, and here is some of its fruit.
The land was so abundant that only a few days they will cross the Jordan River from where they are right now. Only a few days. Moses is going to pass. They're going to mourn for 30 days, and then they're going to cross into the Jordan River. What happens the day that they go into the Jordan River? They celebrate Passover, and what happens? Anybody know? With regard to food, what happens? The manna stops. They have no more food from God. Guess where they got to get the food? The land. Okay, so these people cross over into the land. All right, this is Joshua 5:10 through 12.
And while the Israelites were camped at Gilgal on the plains of Jericho, they celebrated Passover on the evening of the 14th day of the first month. And the day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate of the produce of the land, unleavened cakes and parched grain. And the manna ceased the day after they ate of the produce of the land, and there was no longer manna for the people of Israel. And they ate of the fruit of the land of Canaan that year.
So this is somewhere between 3 and 6 million people. This is a group. You got a picture, 3 to 6 million people traveling along as one big band, and there was enough food for them to just go out and, hey man, I'm hungry. I'll grab this banana and a pomegranate, and there was grain. They ate the parched grain from the land because this would have been the first harvest of the of the year. In fact, what they did is they celebrated Passover. Guess what? They also celebrated first fruits because they took the parched grain and they cooked it and they offered it up to God, and then they were allowed to eat it themselves, and that's when the manna stopped. I'd like to go into talking about how Jesus, Yeshua, is the first fruits and all the things that happens on Passover. But be here for Passover. We always cover it every year, and we'll cover it more in detail then. This is the place where they cross the Jordan. This is the location where they surround Jericho. There's food for them, food for the livestock. There's grain in the fields there. It was paradise. It was something like maybe this. Show the next slide, if you would, Jacob. This is God's country. This is where I'm from. This is Idaho. And when we visited Israel, it was a lot like Idaho in the summertime. It's hot, fairly arid, but in a lot of ways it was a lot nicer because it wasn't trashed up. There's so many people in the country and so many different types of cultures in the country that it's bordering on first, second, and third world, depending on which community you're in. If you're in a Bedouin community, it's third world. If you're in an Arab community, it's second world. If you're in mostly in the Jewish communities, and it'll be first world, okay? And this is the most productive grain land in the world. This is called the Palouse, northern Idaho. And they get upwards over 250 bushel of grain, and they don't water anything. There's no irrigation there. That's all dry land farming, so that's all done by rain. And that is basically what the Negev looked like. You don't believe me? Next slide. That's what it looks like today. Go ahead and go back if you can, Jacob. That's what it used to look like when they were entering the land. This is what it looks like today.
Brown.
Brown.
It's gonna be great.
Florida. Give me Florida. Now, what does Jehovah have to say about that? Now, I'm going to be very specific today because I have to be. I'm going to call Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, God's name, which you put appears over 6,000 times in the Bible. Okay, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh in the Tanakh shows up 6,000 times. So I'm going to be very specific and call him Jehovah. If you have a preference and you like Yahweh or Yahuwah or whatever, that's fine. I'm not calling him Lord, the Lord, because the Lord actually means Baal. And I'm not going to say God, because there is a pantheon of gods out there. I'm going to be very specific. I'm using that, so if you're new, I'm not an ineffable name or any of that kind of doctrine. I'm just being very specific about, I'm talking about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because that's going to matter later on when we get into the conversation here. So, Jehovah, what's he got to say about this situation? And that's where our Torah portion starts. And if you go ahead and reread, starting at verse 29:10 in Netzavim, then we'll set the stage for what is happening to the land, or what is about to happen to the land, and how we end up with that.
All of you are standing today before Jehovah your Elohim, leaders of your tribes, elders, officials, and all the men of Israel, your children and wives, and the foreigners in your camps who cut your wood and draw your water, so that you may enter into a covenant with Jehovah your Elohim, which he is making with you today.
Okay, he's making a covenant with the people on that very day. Everybody who enters into covenant with God, with Jehovah, through Yeshua, Jesus, is in this covenant here. Don't believe me? Continue.
And into his oath, and so that he may establish you today as his people, and he may be your Elohim as he promised you, and as he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I'm making this covenant and this oath not only with you, but also with those who are standing here with us today in the presence of Yehovah, our Elohim, as well as with those who are not here today.
As well as those who are not here today. That's what Rabbi talked about before we ever started services. This is the DNA of the future. These are the people, this is you, that he's speaking to here. Verse 16.
For you yourselves know how we lived in the land of Egypt and how we passed through the nations on the way here. You saw the abominations and the idols among them made of wood and stone, of silver and gold. Make sure there is no man or woman, clan or tribe among you today whose heart turns away from Yehovah our Elohim to go and worship the gods of those nations. Make sure there is no root among you that bears such poisonous and bitter fruit. Because when such a person hears the words of this oath, he invokes a blessing on himself, saying, I will have peace even though I walk in the stubbornness of my own heart.
These are people that walk among the righteous people thinking, you know what, I'll be all right because God's going to rain on them and I'll be the beneficiary of this. That's kind of what's going on here. I'm going to walk in the stubbornness of my heart and I'm still okay. I'm going to be just fine. Continue, please.
This will bring disaster on the watered land as well as the dry.
This will bring disaster on the watered land as well as the dry.
Jehovah will never be willing to forgive him. Instead, his anger and jealousy will burn against that man, and every curse written in this book will fall upon him. Jehovah will blot out his name from under heaven and single him out from all the tribes of Israel for disaster, according to all the curses of the covenant written in this book of the law. Then the generation to come, your sons who follow you, and the foreigner who comes from a distant land, will see the plagues of the land and the sicknesses Jehovah has inflicted on it. All its soil will be burning waste of sulfur and salt, unsown and unproductive, and no plant growing on it, just like the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah, and Zeboim, which Jehovah overthrew in his fierce anger. So all the nations will ask, why has Jehovah done such a thing to this land? Why is the great outburst this great outburst of anger? And the people will answer, it's because they abandoned the covenant of Jehovah, the God of our fathers, which he made with them when he brought them out of the land of Egypt.
Did you get that? Okay.
Come back and do it?
Yeah, please. Just reread that little bit there. Why is he doing this? Go.
It is because they abandoned the covenant of Jehovah, the God of their fathers, which he made with them when he brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went and served other gods, and they worshiped gods they had not known, gods that Jehovah had not given to them. Therefore, the anger of Jehovah burned against this land, and he brought upon it every curse written in this book. Jehovah uprooted them from their land in his anger, rage, and great wrath, and he cast them into another land where they are today.
Now, he's speaking in present tense. Did you notice that? He's speaking history future when he's talking here. History, future. This is already a done deal. I find that to be fascinating. Continue with verse 39, and we'll get moving here.
The secret things belong to Jehovah our Elohim, but the things revealed belong to us and to our children forever, so that we may follow all the words of this law.
Okay, we're not done reading the Torah. But that's only the lead-in, and that's a lot to digest. But for me to even try and paraphrase any of that would be a waste of time, because that's about as succinct as it gets. I can go back through and try and summarize, but basically, if you believe, you've entered into covenant with God Almighty, Jehovah, and you're going to say, I'm going to do everything that you ask me to do, and then you turn around and don't do it, then curses rain down on you. There's a second half to this story. We'll get to that in a minute. But the curses rain down on you. This paints a pretty grim picture of what happens or what is going to happen to God's chosen people as they descend into apostasy. He will make an example of all who are in covenant relationship with him. If you're obedient, he will make you an example. And if you're not, he's going to make you an example. I'm confident that makes sense. What we read, or what I experienced when we landed in Israel, when we were flying in on the airplane, you can see much of the country. It was overcast a bit, so we weren't able to see much of it. But it looked pretty much like I expected, because I Google Earthed and done my study and did all those things. And when we're landing, it looked pretty much like I expected. And when we touched down and I touched the ground the first time, I felt nothing. Part of what happens when people visit Israel, they typically go with a large religious group, and the Spirit of the Lord, the Spirit of Jehovah is with them, typically. You have somebody that's leading the charge, and you have enough people where two or three are gathered, and the Spirit of the Lord is with them. I am with you. That's not how we went. It was TJ, Shimon, and myself, and we spent most of our time with secular Jews, friends, and guides, and we did all of this solo. So I feel like we experienced the real Israel and not the kumbaya and Jesus walked here Israel. And there is a difference. What I saw when we landed was the fruits of apostasy. What I saw was sad. As I said, we showed what the Negev looks like today. It's nothing like what God wanted it to be, and it's nothing like it was when the children of Israel inherited it. It's not from global warming or global climate change. It's Godful climate change. The thing that makes me sad is that as we descend into apostasy in the United States, that beautiful land called the Palouse, where I'm from, is going to look just like that. And it's not going to be from global climate change. So why is Israel currently like this? Aren't the people back in the land? Well, we did the regular stuff. We did the Jerusalem, the Wailing Wall, and under the temple, and the Mount of Olives, and we went up north to the Galilee, and we went to the Dead Sea, and to Masada, and to Megiddo, but the things that actually I found most meaningful for understanding was going to the Valley of Tears, which is the far north of Israel, with Ariel, who's IDF Special Forces. He's been shot. He's actually been shot in battle, who's the one who got buried. And we went to the Valley of Tears Memorial. There's three Israeli tanks there. They're shot, blown up tanks that are left over from the Yom Kippur War. Those were the only three tanks, operable tanks, in the region. And they defeated, with no bullets, over 1,000 Syrian tanks that were crossing the border. 1,000 with no bullets and inoperable tanks. Now, the Israelis will say it was brilliant maneuvering, and it was brilliant and courage and all of those things, which it was, because these guys had no chance. And you have to go to the Arabic history to find out what actually happened. The Israelis, this isn't recorded in their history, but it is recorded in the Arabic history. And that is that the Arab forces saw an apparition of Abraham come down from the sky, and they were so terrified that they ran. That's actually what happened. They did run, and they left all of their gear, their guns, their tanks, their bullets, their everything, and ran on foot and just abandoned it all. And the Israelis mounted an offensive and managed a miraculous, miraculous victory. But if you ask the Arabs what happened, it wasn't the Israelis that whooped them. It was a supernatural event that occurred. The other part of what we did is we went to four museums. We went to the museum where the Dead Sea Scrolls are, which was nice. But we also went to Yad Vashem, which, among other things, houses the Holocaust Museum. And it's the most visited site in Israel, so it's not a surprise that we would go there. The way the museum is arranged is you start in one end and zigzag through this kind of concrete, confining environment. And it leads you through how the seeds of anti-Semitism starts. Now realize, I'm not Jewish. I'm not of Jewish descent. So I'm just looking this as an observer from the outside. And you see how, and it's intentional. They do it this way to show that because many people ask, why didn't they just leave? Why didn't they just do this? Why didn't they just do that? But this museum leads you through the progression of how, and you zigzag through this thing, how the Nazis started persecuting them in small ways, and then in greater ways, dehumanizing them, propagandizing them, to the point that they became subjugated, and they were actually no longer humans. You could kill them because they were no longer even human. There was also other things that was in the display that really caught my attention, and it was the testimonials of the survivors of the Holocaust that they've recorded. And it's them speaking in Hebrew, and I'm reading the subtitles. And among them, the testimonials were how they were sent every day to critical race theory classes. Hello. I didn't make that up. Every single day they were sent to critical race theory classes to indoctrinate the children. When I got out the other side, I was angry. I read Bonhoeffer, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. It was a biography about his life during the war. And the way that Hitler took over Germany, Nazi Germany, before it became Nazi, it was Christian Germany. He had to neutralize the Christian church. And if you read Bonhoeffer, it's death by a thousand paper cuts. He got the church to just give a little here and a little here and a little here and a little here. And by the time that Hitler took over and seized power and was ready to move forward with his agenda, they had no standing. They had no moral standing. They had no economic standing. And they sure as heck didn't have any spiritual standing, because they had conceded on every point. This walking through the museum just highlighted how it was death by a thousand paper cuts. And at the end, 6 million Jews go to gas chambers. It reminded me a lot of the last 4 years. It's death by a thousand paper cuts. I won't go into. I got out the other side, and everybody, most of you know that I'm an engineer, and we own a business that designs hospitals, laboratories, and university research facilities. That's what we do. And in order for me to do that, I have to know a little something about viruses and how to contain them, because they're working in the laboratory that if I designed it wrong will kill them. Not only will that kill them, but the virus will escape the laboratory and kill everybody else, Wuhan. I got to know a little something about containing viruses, and everything that you all think you know about viruses is wrong. And those masks don't do anything for you. Not only is that, was that something I was telling everybody when this whole thing started from here, but now finally the research is coming out and they're saying the same exact thing. Oh, not even the N95 mask is effective at all. And they said it, and the end of the report says full stop, period. When I got out of the museum, I was so incensed that I kind of lit into our poor tour guide, who is a secular Jew. We'll talk about what a secular Jew is. Who's a secular Jew? Basically, she's an atheist. But culturally, she lives in the land of Israel and is a Jew by descent, and she identifies that way. When I got out of there, I go, don't you see what is going on? Israel is the most vaccinated country in the world. They were the most locked down country in the world. They complied with everything. It was just like walking through that dang museum. Death by 1,000 paper cuts. Comply, comply, comply. Then we went to the Friends of Zion Museum. That was enlightening. What's the Friends of Zion Museum, you ask? Well, it's held up as the people who had the visionaries who aided in the creation of the current state of Israel. What it actually is a museum memorializing and holding up the people, or venerating the people who are not Jewish, that wanted to artificially usher in the millennial kingdom. And through scripture, selective scripture reading, they said, we're going to create this land of Israel, and then Yeshua, Jesus, will have to return and establish his millennial reign. Like God is somebody like a minionette where you just pluck his strings and he'll do whatever you want. That's literally what that museum is about. Among the notables were John Nelson Darby, Prescott Bush. Anybody know who that is? Who is it? Father of George Bush and W. Bush, who, by the way, are not Christians. In fact, George Bush was asked if he was a Christian one time in an interview, and he said he thought for a long time and finally said, well, have I been born again? The answer is yes. There's a procedure, a ritual they go through, a ceremony they go through, because he's a member of the Skull and Bone Society. And in that ceremony, you get into a coffin and they hurl insults and blood on you. And then you reemerge from that thing and then you're born again. That's what he was referring to. Winston Churchill, another godless man. The Rothschilds family. Balfour. Balfour Declaration. All of these people are being venerated, and yeah, I'll just move on. I didn't, other than maybe Corey Ten Boom, I didn't really see a person that they were holding up as a model of a Christian Zionist that I would, anyway, I'll leave my opinions at the door. The problem is the Israeli people don't own the land. This is a phony society. The government controls the land. If you go there, you can't build a house on your land. You don't buy land. You negotiate with the government, and then you can put a house on there, but they own the land. Or if you were a farm, a to farm, you have a you would negotiate with the government to use the land to farm on. But the government doesn't own the land either. The Rothschilds and the British Crown owns the land. And whoever owns the land owns the government. We finally went to, on our own in Tel Aviv, we went to Anu, the history of the Jewish people. If you'd go back to the timeline, Jacob, I'd appreciate it. I went to the history of the Jewish people. The history of the Jewish people, according to the people who live there now, their history doesn't start here. Their history starts right there. Go look for yourself. It starts after the Babylonian captivity, not before. So all of that, they don't even recognize it. They might give lip service to it, but they don't recognize it. They are, when they left Babylon and entered the land, this was a ragtag group of purely pagan people. In fact, when Ezra and Nehemiah read them the law the first time, they wept. They cried because they didn't realize just how pagan and how sinful and how evil they actually were. After the Babylonian captivity, the priesthood didn't even exist. So everything that the people knew and everything that the people were taught came from rabbis, teachers. And the teachers got their control by writing what they thought the people ought to do. The thing they wrote was called the Oral Torah or the Oral Law. And it's in their own words. Now, this is coming, this isn't me talking. We visited the museum. In fact, would you forward to the first museum slide there? This is a display that I took some pictures off of the little kiosks and the display centers. And I'm quoting from their stuff. I'm not making this stuff up on my own, okay? When they left Babylon at the end of that Babylonian captivity, the guiding and governing works of Scripture weren't Scripture at all. It was the Babylonian Talmud. The Talmud is actually written by several different rabbinical authors. And this is all on the display there. This is proudly displayed, actually. And in the 13th century, we get the Kabbalah added to the mix, which is Jewish mysticism. It's Jewish mysticism. Let's just leave it at that. It's an esoteric writing. You know what esoteric means? Hidden knowledge. It's esoteric writing, so there's hidden knowledge all over it. According to the museum, this Babylonian Talmud is the foundation for all Orthodox Jewish faith. Okay? It's not the Bible, not Scripture, not the Old, and it sure as heck isn't the New Testament. It's a Babylonian Talmud, which actually didn't, it was oral. I guess it makes it easier to change it when it's oral, until they started writing it down, in later centuries. It's after Yeshua's death. The Jewish people go to great lengths to use humor in their society, and you see it in our television programs and so on, that where they use the irony that not two Jews can get along, because they show, I follow Rabbi Akiva, and I follow Rabbi so-and-so, and I follow Rabbi so-and-so, and they, in order to keep from strangling each other, they do make a joke out of all of that stuff. So you have the Orthodox people. It's its own religion, and they have their own idol, and its head is a rabbi, and its document, its doctrine, is derived from the Babylonian Talmud or the Kabbalah. It influenced the structure of the government. That's why the government services shut down on Shabbat and start back up after Shabbat. Actually, they don't. The hypocrisy of it all is baffling. And the Bible isn't even mentioned in this museum. It has no position. It has no authority. The museum lists the major Orthodox faiths. They even have this interactive display, which is dedicated to Metatron. Anybody know who Metatron is? Metatron is a Kabbalistic, part of the Kabbalistic writing. It's Enoch, supposedly. When God raised Enoch up, instead of letting him die, he took him, as like Elijah, he took him up into heaven. This is in early in Genesis, and Enoch was not, for God took him. So God, he takes Enoch into heaven, and because of his good deeds, God turned him into an angel. Oh, it gets better. It's way richer. This is an interactive children's kiosk. Go to the next slide. There you go. One I'm playing on it right there. And what you do is Enoch now becomes Metatron. Metatron is this character who is number two to God and only sort of subordinate to him. He's kind of the guy that takes over when Jehovah's having a mani-pedi, you know, or is on vacation. Not joking. I am not making this stuff up. Go look it up for yourselves. And so in this interactive kiosk that you get with the children, you go through and you're given a task, and it even says Metatron's, you know, mission, and then in parentheses it has down below it, what is the writer of I can't even remember the name of the series of books that the British lady wrote for children, Harry Potter. In parentheses, it says Harry Potter down there. So they're given a Metatron Harry Potter scenario. Abraham comes along and he introduces the kids to Metatron. Metatron. You know, and Abraham has this wimpy voice, you know. And when Metatron comes down, it sounds like the voices on, you know, like Transformers or something. Metatron, you know, and here, oh, children, I have a task for you. You know, and you go through and you have to select what the right thing to do is as you go through this creepy. I went through the whole thing while TJ and Shimon went someplace else, so I could just see how creepy it was, this indoctrination process. That within the Kabbalah is Metatron's cube, which is sacred geometry, and all of the secret societies can trace themselves back to the Kabbalah. When you hear the pejorative term cabal of people, that's just shorthand for Kabbalah. And this sacred geometry is where the Masonic Freemasons find their origins, and they use this, and overlay Metatron's cube on Washington, D.C., everything that in that town is a subset or a piece of Metatron's cube. There's also a piece of what we'd like to, yeah, this is the all-seeing, oh, it's crazy. But it's all pagan evil. And then you mix in the religion. Those are the religious people. Those are the good people. And you mix in with that traditional religious Jews. Traditional religious Jews are people who they don't wear the thing and the hat and the penguin suit and, you know, and do all the things. But they still keep Shabbat, and they give lip service to the holidays. And most of them will tell you it's just every one of the seven major religious holidays or Jewish holidays is just a good excuse to get drunk. Then you have the traditional non-religious Jews, and they also follow those same things, only they do it specifically for the party and because it's a nice way to get a guaranteed day off. And I'm not making that up either. And then you have the purely secular Jews, which was what one of our guides was, who are basically agnostic at best, but atheist. But again, they're culturally Jewish. And then you have all of these people living in cohabitation with one another. I don't think I have ever been, even when we were flying back and forth from Haiti, I don't think I've ever been in a more godless place in my life. Because he wasn't with those people. Any of them. I'd never seen so much narcissism in my life. I've never seen so much plastic surgery. And I'm in Miami every week. Overt public nudity. It was obscene. And you juxtapose that with the hypocrisy of the Orthodox. You got that one gal with her breasts hanging out sitting to a guy with these thingies and we're all eating schnitzel pitas. Ridiculous. Right? And, you know, Glenn Shabbat, somebody, help me out. From Sunset Friday to Sunset Saturday, okay? You think I can get a train out to the airport on Sunday morning? No. It's Shabbat. No, it's not. Shabbat was at Sunset Saturday. It didn't have anything to do with Sunday. You know, it just goes on. I could go on and on and on. I never experienced a more secular, atheistic posture in my life either. And it was mainly from the young. And this made me sad. I didn't see Jehovah in covenant with his people because everybody I met had rejected his covenant. But fortunately for us in the West, we don't do those things. So let's see. Let's put it to the test. And I'm gonna use the self-professing ones. I only listed a few, and these are ones that I have personal experience with because I'm from and or was involved with some of these different denominational faiths, if you call them that. Let's start with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. That's an Idaho thing. Idaho is just northern Utah. It's not Idaho. Its authority goes to the prophet, who is whoever the old guy is that's sitting in Salt Lake City. He has two advisors, and collectively they're called the presidency, the first presidency. Their authoritative scripture is not the Bible, but the Book of Mormon. No Bible, no Jehovah, no authority. Roman Catholic Church, its authority is the Pope. Its written authority is the catechisms and the encyclicals. No Bible, no Jehovah. In fact, they will tell you, and I have many debates with my Catholic friends, and they'll tell you, that sola scriptura is the easiest thing to refute in all of faith. No Bible, no God. United Methodist Church, yes, I've been there too. Its authority is the annual conference. Its written authority is the Church Book of Discipline. Go to their website. The Bible and Jehovah are not mentioned. The last one that I was involved with was the Presbyterian Church in America. Now, this is a conservative wing, not the PCUSA. They've already gone AWOL years ago, and that's the reason there's a split. This is a conservative wing, and their list is fascinating because they are very conservative. They believe in the Westminster Confession of Faith, the larger and shorter catechisms, the church, the book of church order, the form of government, the rules of discipline. No, go look at their website. No Jehovah, no Bible. I went through the leadership program twice, and I couldn't understand why God wouldn't let me become one of the leaders. I just never would do it. Now I know. Fortunately, we're messianic, and we don't have these problems, do we? We follow a post-Babylonian Jewish tradition. I wonder how many of those are scriptural. Most of them here because of the work of that man right there. And we belong to conferences, Jewish conferences, and there's some stuff we probably ought to clean up. We use icons from the 15th century as our distinctive. We use esoteric icons in order to identify with the state of Israel. And we'll talk about those someday, but not now. We use a Babylonian calendar. We're coming up on the High Holy Days.
I have to tell you later my conversation with the Lord yesterday.
Okay. Maybe we do need to talk because I want to do a series on the calendar. Because I want us to start shucking off some of this stuff because I think we have work to do. This is a process. I don't want anybody in here who is truth seekers that are showing up because they're trying to shuck off what they know to be pagan. They know to be wrong from other denominational efforts. And we're all in that process. We're in transition. Hopefully we're going to maintain our same gender, but we're in transition. And I don't want anybody to get frustrated and give up when we step on one of your holy cows, because it's coming. And the reason I ask you to do that is because there's hope. We got to read the rest of the parashat. We had to listen to the curses. Now let's read the rest of the parashat. You want to sing it, hon? Yes. Yes. Do I want you to do the English afterwards? John said he'd do it, but I don't see him. Yeah, bring that mic. Okay.
Yep, that's English. I guess that's English. This is. This
you want to do it from the Torah? You want to do it here?
Oh, I'm going to do it.
Okay. I'm going to follow you, right? I'm going to check you. Okay, now TJ is actually going to chant it in the Jewish tradition. If you were to, yeah, we got to. It's not usually just spoken, it's sung. And the singing is done, there are several different styles, and she has chosen one that she learned from the Chabad tradition, so please.
You don't have to stand for
reading.
Remember I let you sit? Mm-hmm. You don't have to stand. The tradition is not to stand when you're reading. Mm-hmm. When they're reading, stand at the beginning and you stand at the end.
Your end.
So that is the tradition in the synagogue. I learned mm-hmm. it from B'nai mm-hmm. Israel for many years.
Go.
Vahaya ki yavou aleha kol hadavarim haele habaraka vehakalala asher natati lifaneha.
Second line up there.
Behovata el levavecha bekol Hagoim Asher Idihaha Adonai Eloheha Shama Veshavta Ad Adonai Eloheha Veshamata Bekolo Heko Asher Anohi Mitzaveha Hayom Ata Uvaneha Bekol Levavacha Uvkol Navshecha Veshav Adonai Eloheha Et Shevutecha. I'm just going to lose my spot right here. Jerutaha. Rechamecha veshav. Vekibetza mikho hamim asher hefitzeha. Adonai Eloheha shama. Im yihye nidahaha bikse hashamayim shamish. Is that in the right spot? Misham ikibitzcha Adonai Elohecha vesham ikahecha. Very, no, ve, oh, here we go. Beginning of the next one. Veheviaha Adonai Eloheha El Haaretz Asher Yareshu Avotecha Veri. Veyir Sha. Tach vehir vehetivecha vehirbecha miavotecha umal, beginning the next one, umal Adonai Eloheha et
there you go.
Levavecha ואת לבב זרעך לאהבה את אדוני אלוהיך בכל לבבך ובכל נפשך למען חייך.
אמן. אמן.
I gotta tell you, you're awesome. All right. So
this is what I just read. When all these things come upon you, the blessings and curses I have set before you, and you call them to mind in all the nations to which Jehovah your Elohim has banished you, and when you and your children return to Jehovah your Elohim and obey his voice with all your heart and with all your soul, according to everything I'm giving you today, then he will restore you from captivity and have compassion on you and gather you from all the nations to which Jehovah your Elohim has scattered you. Isn't that awesome?
Yes.
And even if you have been banished to the farthest horizon, says Hashemayim, he will gather you and return you from there. And Jehovah your Elohim will bring you into the land your fathers possessed, and you will take possession of it. And he will cause you to prosper and multiply more than your fathers. Jehovah your Elohim will circumcise your hearts and the hearts of your descendants. And you will love him with all your heart and with all your soul, so that you may live. That's what it says.
Let us finish the blessing. The closing blessing. think that's a really good tradition.
So it's basically, actually, honey, I'll hold it up. If you want to take the yod and point out where you were reading from, that'd be great.
Now we stand, okay? And we take a pinky and point to it like she's pointing with her yod. It starts right there. This is the Torah which Moses placed before the children of Israel. It is in accordance with the command of Adonai by the hand of Moses.
Yes.
Now, we would
close it so that it can stay there until we put it away. We won't put it away until you're done.
And I would, if I may, can I leave it open for the people to see?
Absolutely.
Because I would encourage anybody who hasn't seen a Torah up close before to come and look at it, because this one isn't the oldest one we have. How old's the
other one is, right, it was 250 years old in 1994.
So, but I'd encourage you to come and look at that. The process that it goes to create, that takes to create one of those, is extraordinary and for another time. But we still want to finish the reading, because we're not done. That's only the beginning of what the admonition from Moses is. Do you know where you're at? Green.
Reading.
Yes.
Then Yehovah, this is, it continues. This
verse
is,
7.
Verse 7. Then Yehovah your Elohim will put all these curses upon your enemies who hate you and persecute you, and you shall again obey the voice of Yehovah and follow all his commandments I am giving you today. So Yehovah your Elohim will make you abound in all the work of your hands and in the fruit of your womb, the offspring of your livestock, and in the produce of your land. Indeed, Yehovah will again delight in your goodness as he delighted in that of your fathers. If you obey Yehovah your Elohim by keeping his commandments and statutes that are written in this book of the law, and if you turn to him with all your heart and with all your soul.
For this commandment I give you today is not too difficult for you. It's not too difficult or beyond your reach. It is not in heaven that you should need to ask, who will ascend to heaven and get it for us and proclaim it to us that we may obey it. That's what we saw in Metatron. He ascended to heaven to get that for him and then proclaim it to all the earth. That's part of the myth that goes with the Metatron, directly in the face of this writing. And it is not beyond the sea that you should seek it, that you should need to ask, who will go across the sea to get it for us and proclaim it that we may obey it? But the world the word is very near you. It is in your mouth and in your heart so that you may obey it. Amen. See that I have set before you today life and goodness, as well as death and disaster. I am commanding you today to love Yehovah your Elohim, to walk in his ways and to keep his commandments, his statutes and his ordinances, so that you may live and increase, and Yehovah your Elohim may bless you in the land that you're entering to possess. But if your heart turns away and you do not listen, but draw away to bow down to other gods and worship them, I declare to you today that you will surely perish. You shall not prolong your days. You shall not prolong your days in the land that you are crossing the Jordan to possess. I call on heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Therefore, choose life, so that you and your descendants may live, and that you may love Adonai, your Elohim. Obey him and hold steadfast to him. For he is your life, for he is your life, for he is your life, and he will prolong your life in the land that Yehovah swore to give to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Shabbat shalom.